Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story is the podcast helping you make sense of the news. Join me, Katya Adler, every weekday as I take a closer look at the stories making the headlines with insights from the BBC's global network of experts. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 9th of December, these are our main stories. The United States has vetoed a UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, describing the measure as a recipe for disaster. The Israeli military says Hamas has reorganized and is fighting for every centimeter in the city of Khan Yunis. In other news, a former prime minister of Burundi has been sentenced to life in prison for crimes including using witchcraft to threaten the president's life. Also in this podcast,
Shane was such a lovely person, and he certainly represented in some ways the diaspora across the world, and we loved him.
A heartfelt final send-off for an Irish balladeer. The United States has vetoed a UN Security Council resolution in New York calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The US representative, Robert Wood, said the draft text would allow Hamas to regroup and continue to commit what he called terror attacks. He described the resolution as a recipe for disaster, which would plant the seeds for the next war.
And so, we regretfully could not support it. We still cannot comprehend why the resolution's authors declined to include language condemning Hamas's horrific terrorist attack on Israel on October 7, an attack that killed over 1,200 people, women, children, the elderly, people from a range of nationalities, burned alive, gunned down, subject to obscene sexual violence.
Well, 13 of the Council's 15 members voted in favour of the resolution, with the UK abstaining. Earlier, the UN Secretary-General, Antonio Guterres, issued this warning regarding Gaza.
We are at a breaking point. There is a high risk of the total collapse of the humanitarian support system in Gaza, which would have devastating consequences. We anticipate that it would result in a complete breakdown of public order and increased pressure for mass displacement into Egypt.
Israel's ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, had earlier told the Council why his country was against pausing its military operation.
Calling for a ceasefire sends a clear message that Hamas is forgiven for their deliberate atrocities, and Hamas's oppression of Gazans is given a green light by the international community. Hamas, like any terror entity, only responds when its existence is threatened. And without the military pressure applied on Hamas, no amount of diplomacy can secure the release of hostages.
The deputy UAE ambassador to the UN, Mohammed Abu Shahab, had this to say after the resolution failed to pass.
Mr. President, the United Arab Emirates is deeply disappointed with the outcome of today's vote. Regrettably, and in the face of untold misery, this Council is unable to demand a humanitarian ceasefire. Let me be clear. Against the backdrop of the Secretary General's grave warnings, the appeals by humanitarian actors, the world's public opinion, this Council grows isolated. It appears untethered from its own founding document. What is the message we are sending Palestinians if we cannot unite behind a call to halt the relentless bombardment of Gaza?
Well, regarding the US veto, Human Rights Watch said Washington risked complicity in war crimes. Our correspondent Neda Torfik is in New York and has this assessment of the UN Secretary-General's attempt to secure the Security Council's backing for a ceasefire.
A rare push there for the Secretary General to get the Security Council to demand an immediate ceasefire by invoking Article 99 of the UN Charter, a power granted to Secretary Generals, but rarely used. It hasn't been used in decades. But nevertheless, what we saw here at the UN was a quick reaction to the Secretary General's call, with 97 nations sponsoring a draft resolution calling for a ceasefire. But the United States cutting a lonely figure and showing its growing isolation by being the sole member of the Council to veto and block that resolution from being passed. Now, the United States has accepted Israel's argument that a ceasefire would only help Hamas, but much of the world disagrees. In fact, 13 of the 15 members voted in favor of this resolution. The UK abstained, and they very much, these members who voted in favor of this resolution, echoed the Secretary General's words that this was a breaking point for Gaza and they must uphold their responsibility to help the Palestinian civilians.
Neda Torfik. Aid agencies say the humanitarian situation in Gaza is deteriorating rapidly, with one warning that civilization in the besieged Palestinian territory is about to break down. The Israeli military says it's stepped up its offensive, striking several hundred targets over the past 24 hours. Intensified fighting has been reported both in northern areas of Gaza, where Israel previously said its troops had largely completed their tasks, and in the south, where a new assault began this week. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams is in Jerusalem, from where he sent this report.
Israel's military campaign in the north and south of the Gaza Strip has lost none of its intensity. A government spokesman this morning said that over the previous 24 hours, Israel had attacked 450 targets from land, sea and air. It's a remarkably high number. Near the Rafah crossing, destitute Palestinians crowd around a UN car. They're desperate for assistance, but aid agencies are struggling to keep up with the war's humanitarian consequences. 85% of Gaza's 2.3 million people have now been displaced, some of them multiple times. Jason Lee is working in Rafah for Save the Children.
When I look out the window now, I see tents being erected everywhere. Wherever there is space next in front of hospitals, civilians have nowhere to run. The shelters are overflowing, and they're essentially putting up tents everywhere, trying to find as much water, food as they can. And of course, there is not enough sanitation facilities.
Washington is showing signs of losing patience. The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, saying there's a gap between Israel's stated intention to protect civilians and the actual results unfolding on the ground. There's concern, too, over the fate of dozens of Palestinian men seen in this video yesterday, stripped to their underwear, sitting cowed in a street in the northern Gaza Strip, being watched over by Israeli soldiers. Other images showed them being driven away in a truck or sitting in a large patch of bulldozed sand, blindfolded, with their hands tied behind their backs. Israel says it detained them as possible Hamas suspects. Mark Regev, a senior advisor to the prime minister, says troops acted with caution.
The reason they're asked to take their shirts off is because we don't want people with suicide bombings, with explosives who will hurt our people, yes, our soldiers. We've already had too many soldiers fall in battle.
Some of the detainees have already been released. Others are still being questioned. Whoever filmed and released the images, and it's not clear if this was officially sanctioned, seems keen to show that Israel is gradually gaining the upper hand.
Paul Adams. As we heard in the earlier podcast, Vladimir Putin has announced that he will stand for re-election as Russian president, telling an audience of military figures there was no other way. Mr. Putin's term of office expires next year, with elections due to be held in March. Voting is expected to be largely a formality, with leading Russian opposition figures either serving prison sentences or living in exile. I asked our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, whether he thought Mr. Putin had really ever been in two minds about carrying on.
I think most people expected Vladimir Putin to come out and say that he was going to run again. So when you hear Vladimir Putin say, well, I've had different thoughts, you know, perhaps yes or perhaps no. No, I don't buy that. I think he wanted to give the impression that he was being persuaded and talked into it by the Russian people and that it was their decision that had made him decide to run again. But no, I'm sure that he had already decided he wants to remain in power.
And Steve, 22 months since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, big brands have pulled out since then, an estimated 200,000 Russian soldiers dead. How popular is Mr. Putin?
It's a really interesting question. If you listen to the Kremlin, if you read the official opinion polls by polling agencies linked to the state, you will find that 75-80%, more than 80% of the Russian people back Vladimir Putin. I don't think that's a particularly accurate picture. Yes, a portion of society here is fully behind the president, but I think a majority don't care one way or the other. Most Russians have come to the conclusion that they can't influence what happens in their country. They don't have the power to do that now in their country. They can't influence the war. They can't influence policies that the government takes. They can't influence who is going to become the next president. So they shrug their shoulders and they accept the situation as it is. They don't see any alternative. And there's a good reason for that, because over the last few years, the Kremlin has done all it can to remove, to clear away any potential rival to Vladimir Putin and all his most vocal critics, so that if you look at the political landscape here, they simply don't exist. And that is why many people, when you speak to a lot of Russians, they say, well, if not Putin, then who else? Which is astonishing when you think in a country of 140 million people, you hear that so often.
And perhaps Mr. Putin will not leave anything to chance. We can expect perhaps more crackdowns in the months to come.
I think in the run-up to the election in March, what we're going to see from Vladimir Putin, he's going to present himself as the defender of Russia and the defender of Russians. He'll most likely talk about, you know, Russia under attack from the West, from America, from NATO, even though we mustn't forget that it was Russia that actually invaded Ukraine nearly 2 years ago. But he wants to style himself as the only person really capable of protecting the world's largest country. But he'll also be stressing that Russia has a future. He'll be talking about, and is already talking about, Russia's economic future, about improving healthcare, new buildings, improving the roads and things like that. This is what Russians want to hear. Russians want to hear that their country has a future, you know, past the special military operation, beyond the war in Ukraine.
Steve Rosenberg. The former Prime Minister of Burundi has been sentenced to life in prison after the Supreme Court found him guilty of several crimes, including using witchcraft to threaten the president's life. Alain-Guillaume Bognoni had denied any wrongdoing. Will Ross reports.
Alain-Guillaume Bognoni's fall has been dramatic. He was in charge of Burundi's police force in 2015, when many people were angry that former President Pierre Nkurunziza was bending the rules to run for a controversial third term. The US president at the time, Barack Obama, imposed sanctions on him after the police and a youth militia carried out operations to intimidate and silence government critics. This year, after being accused of using witchcraft to kill off the current president, Alain-Guillaume Bognoni went on trial. It wasn't a transparent process and there may be an appeal, but he's now due to serve a life sentence and has had several properties and 14 vehicles confiscated by the state.
Will Ross. Africa currently produces less than 1% of the vaccines it needs. So, why are so few vaccines made? Well, the reasons might seem obvious. Developing them from scratch is hugely expensive, and most of the big pharmaceutical companies are based in the US and Europe, and they control the patents. Well, to boost Africa's vaccine industry, Gavi, that's the Global Vaccine Alliance, which is funded by groups like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, is setting up a $1 billion fund. BBC Africa reporter Dorcas Wanjira told me what the alliance can do.
$1 billion may seem like a drop in the ocean for a continent with more than 50 countries. However, Gavi was clear at the beginning that this first sends a signal to the global community that there's a commitment to support Africa in manufacturing vaccines. So it's just the first step. And what I remember from the board meeting and the decision, they said that this will go, first of all, to the basics, looking at the issue of the startup costs. Like, I know in December, Rwanda, they're launching the BioNTech facility, which is going to be manufacturing vaccines with mRNA technology. So this funding will just help to go to countries first for the very first steps also, and also with the startup costs. But in essence, it may seem like a small amount, but it does send an important signal.
And this is all part of a very ambitious plan going forward, isn't it?
Yes, it is a very ambitious plan by the African Union and the Africa Centers for Disease Control, Africa CDC. I remember I was in Zambia last month and early this month, and I remember the Director General for Africa CDC saying, if Africa is able to make its own vaccines from scratch, it would be like our second independence. The CDC has a goal for Africa to manufacture, to develop, and also to source for, and to also ultimately produce 60% of vaccines for the continent in the continent.
And do many people, this is a very ambitious goal, given that at the moment it's just 1%. Do people really see that as viable?
Well, it's yes and no. Yes, because there is hope if there is support, and that's why funding is very critical, partnerships is very critical, and even access, lifting off patents is also very critical. No, because 1% is still a fraction, and there's a very long way to go. And what this funding has also helped to do is to just kickstart that ambitious goal. What AVMA, that's this facility, the Africa Vaccine Manufacturing Accelerator, hopes to achieve is if this funding is made available to manufacturers, it can help also offset high startup costs and also look at priorities for Africa. Because most of the manufacturing plants in the continent are only doing fill and finishing. So they're not developing their own vaccines from the word go. They're just filling and finishing what is already there. But this is a start. So at the beginning of this ambitious plan, once you have the facilities in these African countries, in December, Rwanda will be launching a facility supported by BioNTech. So once this is set in motion, you'll see more African countries having the facilities first, having the know-how, having the technology, before we get to developing our very own vaccines from scratch.
That was Dorcas Wanjira. Still to come.
The US senator has written a letter to the Department of Agriculture in the United States asking for an investigation into Chinese garlic.
So, what are the concerns about it? Find out later.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland and its legendary Gaelic football team.
I believe in the curse. Yeah, I think it's real.
Is it just superstition? Or could there be more to it?
Sometimes I think there's something sinister going on.
What do we need to do to win an All-Ireland final for Mayo?
Listen to the curious tale of the Mayo curse on Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. This year has seen a record number of migrants entering the United States via Mexico, putting intense pressure on the Biden administration. Republicans in the US Congress are linking the crisis to the war in Ukraine by refusing to approve military aid to Kyiv unless the Democrats approve funds to better police the southern border. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, traveled to the US-Mexico border and sent this report.
This is not what the US Border Patrol are used to. Illegal migrants who have snuck into America lining up to hand themselves in. So many of them that the authorities are overwhelmed. Hundreds of people are waiting for their chance to formally request asylum in America.
Right here in the shadow of the border fence, there are hundreds of people in what you can't really call a camp because there's almost nothing here. There's a handful of tents, some tarpaulins that are actually tied to the border fence itself, providing very little shelter for hundreds of people.
We followed the route all the immigrants are following.
Navid and his wife travelled for 50 days to get here from Afghanistan. He says the journey through Central America was brutal.
They treated all the people, especially Asians, I don't know how to say this, like a dog. But the moment we crossed the border, we felt very different. We felt safe, and we do feel safe.
This crisis on the border is a huge political problem for President Biden, threatening his chances of re-election and even putting aid to Ukraine in jeopardy. Because Republicans in Congress won't vote for more money for Ukraine unless Joe Biden agrees to crack down hard on illegal immigration and basically puts an end to scenes like this.
Migrants are no longer allowed to claim asylum if they turn up at official border crossings. So thousands of asylum seekers are instead coming in illegally, undeterred by that infamous border wall. Here in Hukumba, they slip through a gap between the wall and a mountain ridge. This small town that's known for its hot springs has a population of just over 500 permanent residents, and they now see more than that coming across the border every day.
I think that, you know, they should respect somebody else's property.
Maria Schuster owns the land that the migrants are camping on. She's furious that her trees are being cut down, migrants burn them to keep warm, and that her land's now littered with trash.
So what would you tell the government to do to sort out the crisis on the border?
Close the border. Send them back. We don't know these people.
Okay, look, online. Easy, easy.
All these people have been told to stay here and wait days for their turn to be processed by immigration. The only food and water comes from local volunteers.
Yeah, okay. Oh, my God.
Samuel Schultz worked in disaster relief in Asia for decades. He's now spending his retirement trying to cope with a disaster on his own doorstep.
I have been told by the Border Patrol that the only way this is going to change is if we stop doing this and then people start starving and being hurt and sick and possibly die out here, and then it'll change.
I take it you're not about to stop feeding them in order to try and get the authorities to take responsibility?
No, I'm not going to do that. I mean, I just don't trust them to do it. How can I, seeing what you see around you, how can you possibly trust them?
It's very unusual to see scenes like this inside America, families with children forced to sleep in the open. It's a symptom of the border crisis, and it will also increase the political pressure to tackle this growing immigration emergency.
That report by Sarah Smith at the US-Mexico border. There are plenty of diplomatic rows between Washington and Beijing at the moment. Copyright infringements, human rights issues, and rows over Taiwan. Well, we can now add garlic to that list. The US Senator Rick Scott has urged the Department of Commerce to investigate the safety of garlic imported from China over claims that it's being grown in human sewage and produced in unsanitary environments. The United States is one of China's biggest markets for the root vegetable. I heard more from our Asia Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow.
The US senator has written a letter to the Department of Agriculture in the United States asking for an investigation into Chinese garlic. And in this letter, essentially lays out health concerns about the way it's produced. Specifically, what he says, it's grown in human feces, euphemistically known as night soil, and also it's then washed in bleach to make it look whiter. So essentially what he's saying, it's just not safe for US consumers to eat.
Do you think there's genuine concern here about the safety issue, or is the US and this individual perhaps just trying to tarnish the reputation of Chinese imports?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's very difficult to get to the bottom of whether it's safe or not. These kind of allegations have been around for quite some time. The US government itself has done an investigation into agricultural products from China and says they're mostly safe. A Canadian university a couple of years ago also did its own assessment mentioning Chinese-grown garlic. It said it was largely safe. So even though night soil is used still in Chinese agriculture, it's thought the garlic there is generally safe. And we've got to say as well, human waste is used all around the world, really, and has been for many years, and is safe if it's treated properly. I mean, that's the important thing, whether or not it's treated properly.
And should we view this perhaps in the context of the economic battles and cultural battles, to a certain extent, that go on between Beijing and Washington?
Yeah, I think you can't look at it just in isolation. This is not just about garlic. President Trump launched a trade war with China, and at that time he introduced a tariff on Chinese garlic imports, and that benefited US growers because they then could sell more garlic to their home consumers. So you've got to look at it in that context as well. Banning or limiting imports of Chinese garlic into the United States helps US producers. You also mentioned culturally there as well. The United States at the moment is going through a period where they view China as a real enemy on all kinds of things. And just today, for example, new sanctions were brought against companies thought to be using slave labour from Xinjiang. That's an area in China. So certainly a lot of people are looking sceptically at what goes on in China. I think we've got to see this attack by this senator in that context.
Mickey Bristow. The International Olympic Committee says competitors from Russia and Belarus will be allowed to take part in next year's Paris Games as neutrals. But participants in the biggest Olympic sport, athletics, are unlikely to compete. Alex Kapstick explains.
Sports federations get the final say and most have followed the IOC's lead, but not all. Athletics has barred all Russian and Belarusian participants and has shown no sign of deviating from that position while the war in Ukraine continues. Before the announcement, Ukraine's sports minister had called on the IOC to make a responsible decision, which will not allow Russia to use sport for military propaganda, even if it's under a neutral flag.
Alex Kapstick. The funeral has taken place in Ireland of the musician and Pogues frontman Shane McGowan. He died last week, aged 65. Among those who attended the service in County Tipperary was the Irish president Michael D. Higgins and the actor Johnny Depp. Well, at the Mass, Shane McGowan's sister said he had achieved his dream of following in the footsteps of the great Irish lyricists and musicians. She told mourners he did so with a heart and fire that was not dimmed by his passing. From Dublin, our Ireland correspondent Sarah Gervin reports.
For Shane McGowan, County Tipperary was the place he called home. The town of Nina came to a standstill for what would be his final homecoming. In a service fittingly filled with music, his friend Nick Cave played the 1986 classic A Rainy Night in Soho, a ode to friends lost but not forgotten.
I've been loving you a long time.
There were tributes by other famous friends. Sir Bob Geldof and Johnny Depp both read prayers. U2's Bono sent a recorded reading. As Shane McGowan's widow, Victoria Mary Clark, spoke, gifts were brought to the altar by former members of the Pogues to represent his life. A vinyl copy of a Led Zeppelin album, a Gaelic football shirt, and a copy of the Crock of Gold book, which is a collection of handwritten lyrics and unpublished writing by the singer. This morning, thousands of fans lined the streets of Dublin as Shane McGowan's coffin was taken through the city on a horse-drawn carriage. When it left, there were spontaneous sing-alongs of his biggest hits.
The old town.
Shane McGowan was described as a master of music and lyrics, and his effect was visible as many members of the congregation swayed as his most famous hit, The Fairy Tale of New York, rung out.
That report was by Sarah Gervin. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. Before we go, here's Harry Bly with details of the latest edition of the Happy Pod.
Thanks, Nick. In this week's edition, we hear from the Italian town of Gubbio as it lights its world record-breaking Christmas tree. But there's a twist. It's not actually one tree. A story of perseverance that led to victory. The Irish boxing champion Katie Taylor did what great fighters do. She rose again. And do you have Riz? It's Oxford Dictionary's word of 2023. We speak to the lexicographer, etymologist and all-round dictionary expert, Susie Dent. Join me for The Happy Pod, a collection of uplifting news stories, in this podcast feed on Saturday.
Thanks, Harry. Now, if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Matt Dean. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.